You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Orhan Pamuk's second book of nonfiction, Other Colors, Essays and a Story, is published by Knopf. It's his first publication since he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to this show today. Hello.
Hello.
This book is comprised of 75 pieces, some of them quite short. What led you to organize it in such a fragmented way?
I published a book with a similar title. It was, in fact, the same title some 5 years ago in Turkey, put together my important essay, so to speak. But in between, in the last 5 years, so much had happened, and so I wrote so much occasional or very serious more scholarly essays that I decided to put them together in a volume. But then some of the stuff was too personal, some of the stuff was too Turkish, so I carved out, sort of a narrative of personal story with this book, put together the fragments from so many essays. And also in this Other Colors, there are also some pages from my private notebooks, of course, the publishable parts.
Are the unpublishable parts going to be published?
Well, I'm a graphomaniac. This is a wonderful word Italo Calvino uses to describe a person who needs to write all the time, who enjoys writing, taking notes all the time, and I consider myself a graphomaniac in the sense that I write all the time, but not everything that I write, of course, is publishable. And then, I keep diaries, and of course, there's so much personal in it that 80% is not publishable. I published some selections from my diaries to sections that also sheds light to the books for the lover of the books, of my earlier books. I also picked up pieces, selections from the interviews I do to promote the books. The pieces that I thought that represent the book say, My Name is Red, Snow, Istanbul, why I wrote these books, what does it mean, what were my motivations, and how were the books received, and how did I gather material for these books. There's a lot about them also in Other Colors. Very personal little essays that I thought some of them were look nice, so I also included it. I'm happy about this book in the sense that I did a lot of editing and made a new book with this American publication of Other Colors.
And you've also included one work of fiction, a short story called To Look Out the Window. Mm-hmm. How does it fit in?
The story is also so autobiographical that I regretted not to have changing. I sometimes think that maybe I shouldn't call this an autobiographical story, just a sort of a fictionalized biography.
We call that memoir in many
yes,
cases.
But on the other hand, I published this years ago separately in Granta. And it's a story that represents, some my childhood years where my father used to disappear, and that's a constant theme in my books. And here is another scene of a disappearance of the father, how the little child learns about this.
Your father disappeared and turned up in Montparnasse?
Turned up in Paris, filling notebooks, and then... He aspired to be a writer. He was the son of a very rich businessman, engineer, and he was the He did not want to pursue a business life; wanted to be an artist. But he married early, and this was in 1950s in Turkey. He was heavily influenced by existentialists of the time, a sort of a bohemian understanding of existentialism, and he used to leave us, go to Paris in hotel rooms and keep notebooks. Years later, he gave me those notebooks in a suitcase, perhaps when he realized that he is going to die soon, and told me now that I'm a sort of a well-known author, not maybe I would edit out and publish the publishable parts. Maybe there's something in them. And this triggered me. When I was thinking to write an essay as Nobel Prize acceptance speech. And I wrote my and that speech, my Nobel Prize acceptance speech, is also in Other Colors. I discuss what is literature, what is the meaning of literature, alluding to my father's suitcase, its weight, so to speak, its spiritual weight, which disturbed me because I didn't want my father to be a good writer, or I wanted him only to be a writer.
Well, it's difficult to edit your own father for all sorts of reasons, but perhaps it was a little easier because he left when you were seven, so it wasn't like you had grown up with him and had all those other emotional entanglements. Or did you imagine a man in such a powerful way that you had to deal with the reality as opposed to the myth?
No,
that
he was around. He used to leave us and come back. So I can't say that he left us and that I never saw him. In fact, I had a strong relationship with him. But yes, it's hard editing out your father. In fact, it was so damningly hard for me to read what he wrote because it upset me, and that I thought was what upset me, and it was the weight of literature. That is, I think, and I argue in this article that the weight of literature is that thing that disturbs us and both interest us. It was interesting because it was my father. It was disturbing because I didn't want to learn about the things, the hidden things that were about my father.
My guest is Orhan Pamuk, whose latest book is Other Colors, Essays and a Story, published by Knopf. You were teaching, are you still teaching at Columbia?
I'm teaching every year at fall. I'm teaching at Columbia.
So you're dividing your time between Istanbul and New York.
Exactly.
You've written about Istanbul's ceaseless roar. Is that something New York has in common with it?
Istanbul's what roar?
Ceaseless roar.
Oh, okay. It was the Spanish writer Juan Goytisolo who once compared Istanbul to New York, which made me very happy because these are the only towns that I lived in. My hometown is, of course, Istanbul, where I spent almost more than 50 years. But that New York is my second hometown in the sense that I probably spent 3 years with my wife when she was taking her PhD here. And again, I'm back here teaching at Columbia, enjoy being around Morningside Heights. And I think the cities are similar in the sense that there is all this activity, crowds, that it's a sort of an apocalyptic crowd that you always feel that there is something happening, that you have to join this rush. And I like that. I am definitely an urban person who needs the crowds and also the silence of the night when the whole town is sleeping.
Yeah, you write about a physical need for solitude. And I don't think of New York and Istanbul as places where you can get that, I guess, until everybody goes to sleep. But has it been harder to find time to write since you won the Nobel Prize? Are people constantly demanding
when
your
I received
time?
The prize, my first I had received the prize, my first impulse that it came almost from my blood that this will not change my life. And unfortunately, that was not a realistic wish. It did not change, I would say, of course, my working habits, my character, my devotion to literature. I am in early age. I consider myself in mid-career. There are so many books that I plan that I want to write. So the Nobel Prize did not come to me as a sort of a retirement pension or a sort of a crowning of a one's lifetime work. It is, in fact, came to me what I considered mid-career, midlife. And
in some ways, I'm sure that's better because it seems to have had a negative effect on writers like Faulkner and Hemingway. Kawabata, the Japanese writer, they never wrote anything good after they won the Nobel.
Yeah, that's partly true, partly a cliche. I have to also fight back because then I'm sometimes worried that when my next fiction book, a major attempt that I've been in it for the last 4 years, when it's out, everyone will say that alert may use this cliche. But then I'm so happy about the readers, all the international audience that the prize had bought me. And so I cannot complain about the prize. In fact, my joke about it is, oh, Nobel Prize, it's great. I recommend it to anyone.
You mentioned earlier that you have an almost compulsion to write all the time, and you liken the writer sitting at his desk to the child at play. So writing is like play for you?
I have realized in early life that in order to be a happy person, I have to be alone in a room by myself and invent things, write. In fact, imagine a second world and a world which is more playful, more transparent, and more interesting than the real one, and I'd be happy about that. The fact that I need to be alone in a room and invent also is related to the fact that in my mind's eye, I change my mental image of the world, invent a second world, which is perhaps can be compared to, the rules of which can be compared to the way children play with things. Children know about the world, but then they imitate it and invent a second world, which is very close to it, alternative world, but not the real thing, but something that shows us the real thing.
Now children have a much closer to their sense of fantasy. We grow out of our sense of fantasy. Writers don't?
Well, in fact, being a writer is, I think, strongly believe that keeping the child in you alive, respecting that fantasy, taking it seriously, and framing it the products of that fantasy in such a way that it is, in fact, that fantasy, if it's put in a right frame and if its center is carefully wrote out, shows the truth about life more than fragmentary impressions of daily life.
You say that your father might have become a writer. I mean, he wrote, but he might have become a real writer. But he was too comfortable in his own skin. Do you think that a person needs a certain level of discomfort with himself to become a writer?
I think so. Adorno once said that...
This is Theodor Adorno.
Yeah, Theodor Adorno once said that morality is not feeling at home in any place. I think that kind of irritation, nervousness, uncomfort, anger, unexplained anger, resentment, all sorts of a bit aggressive, negative feelings towards reality, towards others, I understand, for writing. My anger makes my imagination work, but it shouldn't be a very deep anger.
In the case of Adorno, he was forced into exile by Hitler. Mm-hmm. You live in a semi-imposed exile half the year.
Yeah, I'm not an exile. And it's such a touchy subject that I really refuse being labeled an exile. I'm here to teach at Columbia. I had already made for some time ago to teach at American universities because they were asking me to come. But then, yes, I'm pressured in Turkey because of political problems. Sometimes life in Turkey is hard, but I'm going in and out of the country. Maybe I am a quarter exile. I also sometimes challenge people. No one can make an exile in Turkey.
My guest is Orhan Pamuk, the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2006. His latest book is Other Colors, Essays and a Story, published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Orhan Pamuk, whose latest book is Other Colors, Essays and a Story, published by Knopf. And so many of the books have colors in them. White, red, snow implies colors.
The White Castle, the Black Book, My Name is Red, they are all colors in my books. And then since I wanted to be a painter between the ages of 7 and 22, sometimes people think that it's related to that. Perhaps I'm a visual writer. I like writing about scenes, situations through color and the visual colors, and compared to other authors, consider myself heavily visual writer. But not, on the other hand, colors in my books are not symbolic, although there is a lot of color symbolism in Islamic literature. I don't follow it. But now that I have written so many books with colors in the titles, I've been asked this question so many times, and perhaps that's why I chose for the title of this collection of essays, which is fragmentary, Other Colors, saying that, implying that these are the things that I could not put in my books, that impressions, ideas, things that I've lived, which did not find a place in my books, but they are the other colors. That's what I meant, perhaps.
You, all of you, the references you've made to literature so far have been to Western literature, and you write about the Western influences in this book, from Wolfe to Faulkner to Lawrence Stern, less about Eastern influences. And is that because a Western reader will not understand those references? When you do talk about Eastern literature, you talk about 1001 Nights and your continual up and down relationship with that book.
The things that I have learned from Turkish writers, I discussed in my book Istanbul. I've learned how to look at my city, how to maneuver myself in relation to the classical heritage. I also wrote about classics of Islamic literature in my book Black Book, which is a sort of a rewriting of the best of Islamic literature, was in ways located in Istanbul in my Black Book. Here there were lots of articles I wrote about Turkish writers who are alive or a previous generation of Turkish writers, but since they are not known here, I did not put them into the book. Also, I'm a novelist, and a novel is, with its all great glories and achievements in the last 200 years, is such an European subject that I want to have a dialogue with the great masters of the novel.
And a number of the ones that you've talked about were writers who straddled East and West. Dostoevsky, for example, Joseph Conrad.
And there is another one which I do not talk here in this book, which I want to further write one day an article about, is the great Japanese writer Tanizaki. These authors, Conrad, Dostoevsky and Tanizaki, had in their early youth were influenced by Occidentalists. They looked down, despised their culture, looked down upon their culture in their early youth. While they reached middle age, they also decided to go back and embrace the tradition. More or less, that's what I'm perhaps doing in my own way. And so my Dostoevsky essays, especially the one I wrote about the Notes from Underground, is about living at the margins or outside of the West, aspiring for the Western literary forms and sort of consciousness, but being a bit of a developing a sort of an love and hate relationship with West, because of that.
Well, one of the epigraphs in Snow is a line from Joseph Conrad's Under Western Eyes, and you also named one of the chapters in Istanbul your
Under Western Eyes.
So is it fair to say that most intellectuals who come from places east of the Danube, say, are conscious of living under Western eyes?
Yes. But then, most of the time, that is such damning and troubled relationship, that living at the provinces, living outside of West, and trying to acquire the heritage of literary heritage of the West, that some of us, we do not want to be self-conscious about it. We push the damning shames, troubles, anxieties about being outside the West and trying to push and force your culture or your being living in the provinces. Most of the time, authors push that under the carpet. I, on the contrary, at least attempted to dramatize it. In all my novels, I also dramatize my marginal point of view, the fact that I'm outside at the edges of Europe, so forth and so on.
Well, you told reporters after you won the Nobel, the metaphor of the bridge between the East and the West is so old-fashioned, so worn out, that it's my job to invent new metaphors. Now, that bridge, of course, is the bridge over the Bosphorus. And you used to work with a view of the Bosphorus in an office which face that intersection of Eastern and Western Istanbul. Was that just accidental? Or did you I have to have an office that has that view?
In Istanbul, I have a wonderful studio which looks Bosphorus, overlooks Bosphorus, and it's inevitable that you see the bridge. And it's such a, because of my writing, because of my location in global culture now, everyone refers to that bridge when they talk about me. It's a cliche that Turkey is between East and West, and it's unfortunately also true. I wouldn't say unfortunately, perhaps. The way I look at the world, the way I write, is, of course, heavily based on these facts, which tend to be a bit of a stereotype and cliche if you underline it too much.
But if you just follow what's going on in the news and the Turkish desire to be part of Europe and also to not be part of Europe, we can say that its soul is divided between the urge to modernize and a desire to remain suspended in the past between secularism and traditional Islam.
What Turkey had lived in the last 150 years, its attempt of westernization, its desire to belong to Europe and West, its willingness to compete with the Western powers, and the representation of classical culture, and coming to and maneuvering in such a way that the classical culture and modernity will hopefully harmoniously come together, are now getting to be problems of the world. What we today called globalization, actually, we Turks lived 100 years ago as westernization, and it's more or less the same thing. How to accept your traditional culture and how to address modernity along with it?
Well, Atatürk tried to force the issue, didn't he? And hasn't that been pretty much imposed on Turkey, but made a fair number of people in the country rather unhappy?
Kemal Atatürk, the founder of Turkish Republic, proposed a radical modernization program. And it was partly successful. But the problem is now to develop a new culture that will both embrace modernity and the tradition. Kemal Atatürk was more focused on political institutions and development of a modern state rather than development of a modern humanistic culture.
My guest is Orhan Pamuk, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2006. His latest book, Other Colors, Essays and a Story, is published by Knopf. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've been seen as having been somewhat reluctant to deal with politics until your novel Snow. Was it in the earlier works only less explicitly, or did something happen to you when you were writing Snow?
No, Snow is obviously intentionally political novel. I have seen in early life that the best talents of previous generation of Turkish writers damaged their books, their lives, in fact, to serve their countries with moralistic tales, with social commentary. And I have decided that I will not be a political writer in early age. Of course, and also, my models were not, say, John Steinbeck or flatly realistic writers. I aspired to be a writer like Marcel Proust, Nabokov, Borges. They were my models. So I refused to go into politics in Turkey. Not that my books were not culturally political, not that they went into all the essential issues that formed the spirit of the nation. But in late 90s, I decided to this time write a deliberately political novel, which in fact that my intention was not to defend a cause, was not to propagate an idea, but to look at, to have another brief glimpse at the spirit of the nation, how we live here in this part of the world, through politics this time.
Did you feel that because you had become a famous writer, you could say things that you might not have been able to say earlier?
That I might have thought when I was doing interviews, but in the novel, I did not think so. But then, I compare myself with other writers operating in my part of the world, more outspoken or more angry, perhaps. I say things. Then I say, well, this is so interesting, I have to say it.
And you said something to a Swiss newspaper, did Tages Anzeiger. 30,000 Kurds and 1 million Armenians were killed in these lands, and nobody but me dares to talk about it. And that
I really have to suffer a lot of intimidation and go to trial for that, but thank God it passed over. But then it was also a stage in Turkey's part. Unfortunately, it fell between Turkey and Europe, their negotiations, and the conservatives in Europe who did not want to see Turkey in Europe, and conservatives of Turkey who didn't want Turkey to join Europe, used and abused this.
And just yesterday, the new Turkish president, Abdul Gül, who's an Islamist, proposed changing the law that criminalizes insult to Turkish identity. Were you surprised that someone
I'm not surprised. He was foreign minister negotiating, handling Turkey's entry to European Union, and he has to change it. And also, he used to be an Islamist, say, 10 years ago. Maybe he is a mild Islamist now. And to refer to the whole politics of Middle East, Islamic countries, all these politicians who do a bit of a use or abuse religion in politics, it's, I think, misleading to call all of them. Some of them are hard, heavy fundamentalists. Some of them are perhaps more close to Christian democrats in the sense the way they use religion. And also it's inevitable that Turkey be more open society and if it wants to approach towards Europe. And the Turkish economy is booming in such a manner that it's hard to control it with such an authoritarian state.
But it is interesting that in so many Muslim countries, democracy actually means an end to secularism.
Well, I don't think so.
That seems to be what's happening in Iraq with the vote suddenly became religious votes. We're seeing the same thing in Algeria and other countries that we saw it in Iran where the Shah tried to keep the country as secular as possible.
In Iraq, that's a major American mistake that in fact, what the world public opinion never recognized the fact that, in fact, although Saddam was a terrible dictator, he was a secular. And now that he is killed and removed, there is and now anti-Western, anti-American, anti-European political Islamist movement going there. And it's partly due to injustices of the terrible war. Not necessarily when there is a democracy and open society in an Islamic country, I strongly think that the political Islam will overtake.
You suggest that there's a Western recklessness that goes beyond George Bush that humiliates the Muslim world and breeds a great deal of anger.
That I wrote and I published here in Other Colors an article called The Anger of the Damned right after 9/11 and trying to see what is the humiliation that major population of the non-Western countries suffer when they look at the West. Not necessarily all the populations of the non-Western world are anti-Western, but there is a sentiment of resentment, anger. How does this come about? And why these people who are not necessarily fundamentalists, but in fact not necessarily politically motivated, why do they hate West and America and Europe and these values which I cherish, but which I also strongly think that we have to address?
Well, you're right. These days, I'm quoting you, these days the lies about the war in Iraq and the reports of secret CIA prisons have so damaged the West's credibility in Turkey and in other nations that it is more and more difficult for people like me to make the case for true Western democracy in my part of the world.
I think that this Iraqi war had destroyed the case for democracy. Not only democracy, Western values which we need, say, women's rights, respect for the minorities, freedom of speech, so forth and so on, cannot now be defended, saying that, look, West had grown richer, developed an attractive civilization based on these values. You cannot argue after the war in Iraq because, of course, they would say, well, they're ruthlessly killing people without any basing it on anything.
One of the stated goals in this country in the Declaration of Independence was the pursuit of happiness. And in one of the essays, you wonder if it's vulgar to be happy.
Yeah.
What conclusions did you wind up coming to?
Well, I think, and I think about this more and more every day, that the business of literature is about happiness. It's not representing the world. It's not about understanding ourselves. If it's about understanding ourselves, it's about motivating us for a greater thing, and that, I think, is happiness. But it is such a trivialized concept that I think we have to see through it, understand it, evaluate it, and honestly think about it. Here in so many personal essays, say in an essay that I talk about my how I take my daughter to the beach and we swim, or in some occasions when I honestly try to address, is the meaning of life happiness, or is constant search for happiness is a vulgar thing? I try to pin down the idea of happiness in all its appearances, in all its the way it pops up everywhere. No, I don't strongly think that the desire to be happy is, of course, a vulgar thing. But then being so so sure about happiness, actually thinking about being having a feeling of contention, to having finding yourself smart because you think you're happy, these are things that upset me. People who are happy about their happiness, perhaps, are the people that I'm most unhappy about.
Because they could be rather annoying.
Yes.
Well, I don't know whether to say I've been happy to have this time to talk with you or not. Orhan Pamuk, who is the winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize for Literature, his latest book is a collection of essays, Other Colors, essays actually, and a story published by Knopf. Should I assume that there's another novel in the works? Or
yes,
short
I'm finishing a novel which will be published in a year in Turkey, and I hope to see it in English in 2 years.
Do you work with your collaborators in the translation?
I work with my English translators heavily. She first translates, then sends me the stuff. I work very heavily on it. Then we sit on a table and fight, argue, and have lots of fun together.
Although you can't do that with the translators into other languages.
Of course not.
So you have no idea what people think of you
now
in
that
Swedish.
Swedish is okay. Now that I'm translated to 56 languages, some of them which I did not know that existed, of course, I have no idea what's happening there. But then Nabokov had once made a remark, and that gave me a little bit of a painful pang when he said, "Oh, I don't know how Lolita behaves in strange languages, such as Turkish," he said.
Of course, remember Nabokov wrote it in English. That was his third or fourth language. That was quite extraordinary. Would you ever imagine writing?
I wrote some articles that I wrote originally in English for book reviews, for TLS. Even I published an article in Village Voice here. But then I decided that it's so painstaking that, and I also have wonderful translators, I should continue writing with my lovely Turkish, which is, in fact, the way I think, the way I dream is all Turkish.
Thank you again so much for being with us, Orhan Pamuk.
Thank you.
Orhan Pamuk will be speaking with Salman Rushdie tonight at 7 as part of the New Yorker Festival. The event is officially sold out, but tickets may be available on the black market, actually just at the festival headquarters. And Mr. Pamuk will be signing books tomorrow night at 5 p.m. at the Metropolitan Pavilion on West 18th Street. For more information, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, Jenji Kohan's Weeds and David Simon's The Wire have gained a lot of critical praise for their intelligent writing. They discuss how they keep their writing fresh season after season. And then later on, we'll find out whether an apple a day really does keep the doctor away. This week's Please Explain is all about apples. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.